This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
In Haiti, gangs are in charge of the capital, not the police.
It's time to say stop the killing. Stop it. Stop murdering us.
Haitians also point a finger at Washington for the problems there. Also today, people in Sweden's Kurdish community are angry with the Swedish government. That's because Sweden needs support from Turkey to join NATO, and Turkey considers certain Kurdish militias to be terrorists.
They sold my people, Kurdish people.
Swedish Kurds now worry they could become targets. And a ship designed to rescue migrants is stuck in port in Barcelona, just waiting for permission to sail.
No tiene explicación, no tiene lógica.
There's no explanation or logic for this, says the founder of the charity that operates the ship. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. Inside Iraq's parliament, there were some wild scenes yesterday. Protesters breached the building, which sits inside Baghdad's heavily militarized green zone. They are allied with Shia cleric and politician Muqtada al-Sadr, someone who gained renown during the American invasion of Iraq. Al-Sadr's movement is in a deadlock with political rivals for control of Iraq's government. With us to break all this down is Hamza Haddad. He's a visiting fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. He joins us from Baghdad. Hamza, what exactly happened in the Green Zone yesterday? How were these protesters able to breach this very tightly secured area?
Well, that's what's on everyone's mind. Yesterday in the evening, protesters started gathering in Tahrir Square in Baghdad, and they made their way to the Green Zone. And without any resistance from security forces, they were able to bring a few T-walls down. And the protesters entered the Green Zone, and eventually from there, they entered Iraq's parliament.
And how were they eventually cleared out of the building?
So throughout the time, there was coverage and live tweeting from various people. But of course, the most important one was from Muqtada al-Sadr himself. And eventually, he had a tweet saying that, protesters, you've done your job. You've scared the corrupt. It's time to go home now. You've sent your message. And you slowly started seeing the protesters make their way back home. And this morning in Baghdad, everything was back to normal.
The protesters are part of Muqtada al-Sadr's movement. Sadr, let's remember, is a former U.S. adversary. What triggered this protest, and what exactly are the protesters' demands?
The protesters were Sadrists, and they were protesting the announcement of the Sadr's rivals, the coordination framework, which is a coalition of the major Shia parties other than the Sadrist movement. They had come together and came out with a statement and said, we have Mohammed al-Sudani as our nominee for prime minister. And then 24 hours later, we started seeing these protests. It was the moment of opportunity for the Sadrist to flex their muscles and show his political rivals that, you know, whoever they choose for prime minister, whoever forms the next government, that they have the ability to mass protest and challenge any government.
So do the Sadrists feel left out of the process?
Well, they put themselves out of the process. In October 2021, Iraq had their 6th parliamentary elections after the U.S. invasion in 2003, and the Sadrists actually won the most seats at the time, with 73. Far from the 165 needed for a majority, but Iraq has yet to see a political party win that much in an election. And so the Sadrists had 73. They were the leading party in negotiating for a government, but they weren't able to bring enough numbers to form a government. And so the Sadrists actually resigned, which was a move that hasn't been done before and caught everyone by surprise.
So the Sadrists during the U.S. occupation were decidedly opposed to the Americans being there. What do they stand for today?
So they claim to be Iraqi nationalists. And in a lot of observers, when they read that, they assume that means anti-Iran. But that's not necessarily true. There's not a single political party in Iraq, whether it's Shia, Sunni, or Kurdish, that's anti-Iran. But what we're seeing in Iraq is, for the first time in many years, some stability. When there's less violence, there's more opportunities for political parties to play politics. And that's what we're seeing now. Political parties trying to play a game of dominance and exert themselves over one another because they see they can take the opportunity to do so.
I think these political rivals could actually work together to get to some kind of agreement on a path forward for Iraq.
Well, Iraq's a funny country in that aspect that, you know, something like what happened yesterday could escalate. Now, having said that, this isn't the first time the Sadrists have actually stormed the Green Zone and stormed Parliament. They've done it before as a form of sending a message, and it's really a strong message. But that's where we have to be cautious and hope that Iraq's political leaders know when to stop playing politics, know when to not push too far, and eventually come together to form a government, because there is no party with a majority and we have to have a coalition for a new government.
Hamza Haddad is a visiting fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. He joined us from Baghdad. Hamza, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
The Mediterranean has the dubious reputation as the deadliest migration route on the planet. People trying to get to Europe typically cross from North Africa, often on overcrowded boats that capsize. The lucky ones are rescued by ships operated by humanitarian groups. The unlucky ones are never found. Last year, a Spanish NGO acquired a new rescue ship with room for more than 1,000 people, plus an onboard hospital, but right now it's stuck in port. From Barcelona, Alan Rusterol reports on why the ship is still waiting for clearance to leave.
The arrival of the Open Arms Uno to the port of Barcelona 2 months ago was cause for celebration. There was live music to welcome the new ship operated by the sea rescue charity Open Arms, the largest and best-equipped vessel in its fleet, which even has an ICU. Politicians came to praise the work of the organization.
Open Arms, durant tots aquests anys, ha salvat tots aquests milers de vides.
But weeks have passed, and the Open Arms Uno has yet to begin operating. The ship remains stranded at port, even as the number of crossings are up, and more than 1,000 people have drowned or gone missing since the beginning of the year. Oscar Camps, who is a professional lifeguard, is the founder of Open Arms. For the past month, he says, he's been telling the crew that they'll leave in a couple of weeks, but the departure date is always postponed. The reason, he says, bureaucracy. He says there's no explanation, no logic for Spanish authorities taking this long to give them the green light. Camps says the philanthropist loaned them the ship last November. It had previously been sailing in the Northern Sea under the Irish flag and had all paperwork in order. The ship was operating in Ireland, so it should be able to operate in Spain too, he says, since both countries are member states of the European Union. But the maritime captain of Barcelona, Javier Valencia, disagrees. In a written response to the world's questions, he explained that the ship was not registered as a rescue boat in Ireland, but one providing support to oil rigs. In addition, the ship was only registered in Spain last month, so the certification process could not start until then. He says it's now nearly complete. Open Arms has described the whole process as administrative persecution to prevent them from doing their work. Itamar Mann is a professor of international law focusing on migration at the University of Haifa in Israel.
Over the last few years, we have been observing European governments trying to prevent a rescue volunteers from reaching points at sea where they can provide help.
He says it's hard to know whether Spain is intentionally delaying the certification of the Open Arms Uno, but what's definitely true is that European governments have been employing similar tactics for years. But that was not always the case. He says that countries once worked together with NGOs to rescue migrants. But that changed with the rise of anti-immigration movements in Europe.
Constituencies at home are often reacting in difficult ways, especially when it comes to people perceiving that their own social economic interests are being imperiled by these migrants.
In cracking down on sea rescue organizations, European governments portray them as a pull factor, saying that migrants dare to cross the sea because they know they will be rescued. But Itamar Mann questions that notion.
There is this perception that if we don't allow people to be rescued, then they will somehow no longer be there. But this is a figment of the imagination. And really, it is also a recipe for catastrophe, because when migrants are not allowed safe routes, they take to the sea in very, very perilous routes.
Back on the ship, Oscar Kamm says the organization is used to harsh situations, be it at sea or on land, or whether it's bureaucracy or legal challenges.
La justicia nos da la razón y la historia nos dará la razón, ¿no?
He says he is hopeful that justice and history will ultimately prove them right. For The World, I'm Alan Ruiz Terol in Barcelona.
From a port in Spain to high up in the Alps, where one restaurant and lodge sitting at 11,000 feet are having a serious identity crisis. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
The Refugio Guide del Cervino is a cozy spot with a gorgeous view. It's a popular place for skiers to warm up, grab lunch, maybe get a drink. When it opened 40 years ago, the restaurant was in Italy. But in the past 15 years, the glacial ridge that defines the national boundary has moved. So now the building is on the Swiss side, or so says Switzerland. The restaurant's manager, Lucio Trocco, says as far as he's concerned, the restaurant's in Italy. Still, he puts out both the Swiss flag and the Italian flag to hedge his bets. Here's what's going on. For centuries, glaciers have kept Switzerland on one side of the Alps and Italy on the other. The border follows something called the watershed line. Let me explain. Basically, the melted snow that flows to the south is Italian. The water that flows to the north, just a few inches away, that's Swiss. Here's the problem. With climate change, the glacier nearby is melting, which means the water flow has changed too. So now, technically, two-thirds of the restaurant is in southern Switzerland, and the rest is in Italy.
We kind of think of borders as being immovable. They're not.
This is Tim Marshall, the author of The Power of Geography. The Alpine restaurant is a funny example, but conflicts on some other borders have become deadly serious. Consider India and Pakistan. The Indus River, which is one of the major rivers for Pakistan, starts as meltwater up in the glaciers of the Indian-controlled section of Kashmir. Marshall says the problem could come later in the century when the glacier melts and the water patterns shift.
At that point, one or the other side could decide to make an issue out of it. For example, if India felt that it was getting less water because of climate change and it needed it for its people and its industry, and it then said, well, look at this water flow and look at where it starts. We are now claiming all of this water. That really is an existential matter.
Border disputes because of shifting climate conditions have led to wars, like between the Soviet Union and China in 1969.
Troop buildups and skirmishes erupted sporadically over the disputed border along the frozen Ussuri River in Siberia.
The flow of the river between the countries changed. An island that Russians said was in Russia was now closer to the Chinese side. Several hundred people died over the dispute. Still, these kinds of border disputes don't necessarily have to end in hostilities, says Tim Marshall.
There's a lovely story of the Norway-Finland border. This was drawn in a straight line in the 1700s.
But modern geologists figured out a quirk at the border on Mount Halti. A mountaineer explained it to Deutsche Welle.
We're standing here on the Finnish Halti. Here to the right, you see the border marker. It's the highest point in Finland. If you look towards the other side, it gets higher, and that's Norway. So Finland's highest peak has a Norwegian summit.
There was a huge petition in Norway to give the peak to Finland. The idea had a lot of public support, and it actually went all the way up to the tops of government.
The government wanted to give the very tip of the mountain to Finland, but apparently this might break Article 1 of Norway's constitution because it says the Kingdom of Norway is indivisible.
Oh, well, it's a thought that counts. Marshall hopes the dispute at the Refugio Guide del Cervino in the Alps will have a friendly resolution. He even has an idea for a compromise.
It's 50-50. The main course will be Italian, and the dessert in the restaurant can be Swiss.
Spaghetti for dinner, Swiss chocolate for dessert? Sign me up. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. The Gaia hypothesis. It proposes that the planet is a complex self-regulating system, a community of organisms that create and maintain the conditions for life. The author of that theory was British scientist James Lovelock. He died on Tuesday at the age of 103, his birthday, in fact. Lovelock leaves behind a vast collection of writing and ideas that continue to influence a new generation of scientists and thinkers. Climate scientist Tim Linton worked with Lovelock and is with us to go deeper into the Gaia hypothesis and Lovelock himself. So Lovelock and his Gaia hypothesis, Tim, can you talk a little bit about that concept?
Jim Lovelock's extraordinary idea that actually came to him when he was working for NASA at the Jet Propulsion Laboratories in the 1960s was the realization that life was both transforming the whole atmosphere of our planet, but also regulating its composition and stabilizing it over geologic periods of time. And that in changing the composition of the atmosphere, that life on the planet was also potentially affecting and regulating the whole climate of the planet over these great swathes of geological time. And he gave it the name Gaia thanks to his neighbor, who was the novelist Bill Golding, famous for the book Lord of the Flies. Golding suggested Gaia as a neat title, referring to the Greek earth goddess.
So not surprisingly, James Lovelock was a man who made connections across the sciences. Speaking with the BBC last year, Lovelock said he thought the sciences were too siloed.
The trouble is, science is too divided up. Physicists know damn all about biology, and biologists very little about physics or geology or anything else. They just stick with their own subject, and that's no way to understand it.
So, Tim, the Gaia hypothesis is about bringing different systems together. Do you think Lovelock's theories help to break down some of those walls between scientific subjects?
For a younger scientist like myself, Lovelock's ideas have been absolutely pivotal in breaking down some of those scientific boundaries. But it's also like that as we tackle the current climate change challenge with bringing, well, social science as well as the natural sciences together. And yeah, Lovelock's played a key role in, you know, focus on the problem, just bring together the expertise you need.
Mm. James Lovelock did not like being called a scientist. He preferred to be called an inventor. I'm just wondering, what did he invent? Or just help us understand what he meant by inventor as opposed to scientist.
Well, apart from inventing this brilliant new view of the world, life being its own life support system, he also famously invented actual instruments, one that is exquisitely sensitive way of sort of smelling gases in the atmosphere is called the electron capture detector. From his inventions, he was able to detect chlorofluorocarbons in the remote atmosphere. So these are the gases that we used to have in our aerosol cans and our fridges that turned out to be destroying the ozone layer. It was Lovelock, through his own instruments and inventions, who, at personal cost to himself, actually went on a boat all the way to Antarctica and found these gases throughout the world's atmosphere.
I gather he used to say that Earth's ecosystems could rebound from human interference. What was his most recent thinking about climate change?
Well, he was one of the real first people to say how serious a threat climate change could be. I mean, he wrote a book in the early 2000s, Revenge of Gaia, in which he painted a pretty bleak picture. I mean, it had phrases in it like, humans might be reduced to a few breeding pairs in the Arctic. I mean, it was really pretty apocalyptic stuff. But interestingly, it wasn't really so far from the mainstream science of the time. It was just the way he was able to see it through his own lens and to say it in simple terms.
Tim, you kind of tipped to this earlier, but remembering that you also worked with Lovelock, what did he and his ideas mean to you personally?
Well, I first read Jim Lovelock's books on Gaia when I was an 18-year-old kid who'd gone up to university in Cambridge and was kind of a bit depressed with what they were teaching me. And his books, they just captivated my younger imagination. I just at that moment, I thought, damn, this is what I want to study and put my efforts into. That was my calling as a scientist. So I wrote him when I was an 18-year-old kid and said, oh, I'd love to, you know, research on this, because he'd put a literal call at the end of his one of his books was, we need a practitioner of planetary medicine. Is there a doctor out there? So I wrote saying I'd quite like to become one. Can you help me? And he's a humble guy, and he said, come and visit. And I did when I was 19. And so for me, that started a friendship which changed the whole course of my life, I think.
Amazing. So as to Lovelock's grim prediction that if things continue apace, humankind will be drawn down to pairs of humans in the Arctic barely surviving, how do you feel about that idea, and how do you see your work continuing forward to maybe prevent that?
I don't see it quite that bleak, but I'm not far off. In my own work, we've been looking at, well, where do we end up if we go where current policies are taking us, into a globally 3 degrees centigrade warmer world? Something like 3 billion people will be put into unprecedented hot climate conditions. And I can see a lot of reasons to be worried about whether our civilization will weather that particular storm. But I'm not entirely a pessimist, because Lovelock's thinking really taught me all about what are called feedback loops. And we see extraordinary amplifying of good things, like the declining price of solar power, wind power, batteries for electric vehicles, positive tipping points. They're happening around us right now. So we run the risk of like really damaging climate tipping points on the one hand, but we're seeing the opportunities of positive tipping points in the economy and society on the other hand, and they're the things that can save us from the kind of bleak scenario that Jim Lovelock portrayed if we don't act.
Tim Lenton is a director of the Global Systems Institute at Exeter University in the UK, helping us remember scientist and inventor James Lovelock, who died this week at the age of 103. Tim, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
The Russian attack on Ukraine has triggered so many different global subplots, from food shortages to pressure on Europe to get off Russian energy. In the midst of all this, basketball star Brittany Griner continues to be detained in Russia. We've learned that the pressure to get her release led the White House to propose a prisoner swap. There had been a lot of speculation over whether the U.S. would take this on. Yesterday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken confirmed they have.
We put a substantial proposal on the table weeks ago to facilitate their release. Our governments have communicated repeatedly and directly on that proposal.
The proposed swap is for Brittany Griner as well as American Paul Whelan, also jailed in Russia, reportedly in exchange for the notorious Russian arms dealer Victor Boot. He's currently serving time in a U.S. federal prison. Blinken also said that he's scheduled to speak soon with Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, and is planning to discuss the proposal. It would be their first call since the war in Ukraine began. Protestant evangelicals in Brazil have grown into a political force, helping to shape national policies with the backing of President Jair Bolsonaro. Check out our series about Brazil's evangelicals at theworld.org/sacrednation. 9 centuries on, a Persian poem is still inspiring artists.
It's been recognized as kind of the Persian version of Romeo and Juliet, for example.
The American blues rock group Tedeschi Trucks Band knows the poem and has now put their spin on it. Plus, China launches a rocket into space. Debris will be falling to Earth this weekend. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We are a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Sweden and Finland are still in the process of joining NATO, but Turkey, a member of the military alliance, is threatening to derail their bids for membership. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has accused the two Nordic states of being havens for Kurdish terrorists, and he wants the governments to hand over dozens of suspects. People from the large Kurdish immigrant community in Sweden are worried that an agreement with Turkey could put them in jeopardy. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Amineh Kakabaveh is an influential Swedish lawmaker of Kurdish descent. She tells me she feels betrayed by her own government in Sweden.
That government is not worth it. They are not worth it. They sold my people, Kurdish people.
Kurds make up around 1% of the population in Sweden. Kakabave fled there in 1992 as a political refugee. She was a member of the Peshmerga for 6 years. They're a Kurdish military force based in northern Iraq. Kakabave was just 14 when she joined up.
One night I made an appointment with the Peshmerga, so I went to the mountain and I lost a lot of my friends, more than 250 during the time I was Peshmerga, many of them in the Saddam Hussein's chemical attacks.
Kakabave says she was also injured in a chemical attack. She was still only 19 when she arrived in Sweden. At the time, the country had a reputation for being a welcoming place for refugees.
If you go back to the 70s, 80s, 90s and onwards, Sweden did have a very liberal, very open immigration policy.
That's Jonas Hinfors, politics professor at the University of Gothenburg. He says those days are now over.
That has changed completely post-2015. Now we are very strict in terms of immigration, etc., etc.
And lawmaker Amina Kakabave says this recent agreement between Sweden and Turkey over NATO membership makes Kurds feel even less welcome. The full details of the deal have not been revealed, but a NATO statement says that the Swedish government has agreed to consider any extradition requests by Turkey. That means Kurds living in Sweden, accused of being terrorists by Turkey, could be deported. Kakabave says her community is rattled by the news.
There is a lot of fear because the government openly has expression that the Swedish citizens should not be afraid. But I mean, what about other people? They are not Swedish.
Kakabave says no such assurances were given to Kurds in Sweden. The Swedish government, like Turkey and the United States, considers the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK, to be a terrorist group, but not the YPG. This is another armed Kurdish group who, along with the Syrian Defence Forces, have been central to the fight against ISIS. The EU and the US see the YPG as an important ally, but Turkey doesn't make this distinction. It sees both Kurdish groups as terrorists. Mikael Salin is the former Swedish ambassador to Turkey. He tells me he's taken aback by just how much Sweden and Finland now appear to accept the Turkish position.
I was surprised, I have to say, because I didn't think that the two countries would go as far as we did in terms of acknowledging the righteousness of the Turkish narrative. I mean, there was a high degree of understanding for the Turkish view of things.
Sweden now says it will no longer support the YPG. In NATO's recent statement, there was no mention of the role the Kurdish militia have played in fighting ISIS. And Salin says this was a big mistake by the Nordic countries.
It's a scandal that in that trilateral agreement there was no mention of ISIS. The whole question of terrorism in that part of the world should mention ISIS, because ISIS is so important when we evaluate the role of the YPG, of course.
Salin says it's not clear how Sweden or Finland would meet Turkey's demands for handing over terrorism suspects. The Turkish president now claims that Sweden has promised to extradite 73 people back to Turkey. Politics professor Jonas Hinfors says that's unlikely to happen.
If you look at the deal, all extraditions have to follow both Turkish law, Swedish law and international law. And from that point of view, it looks like that there are sort of safeguards to prevent at least the Turkish view to be the only one that decides whether someone should be extradited or not.
But Hinfors says Kurds in Sweden might find themselves under more scrutiny from the authorities there. Lawmaker Amina Kakabave travels everywhere now with a bodyguard. She says she gets threats not just from Turkey, but also from far-right extremists in Sweden. Political analysts say the Swedish government will do whatever it takes to join NATO. But Swedish lawmakers have other things on their minds too, like a general election this September. Amina Kakabave has decided not to run for re-election, and Jonas Hinfors says the current government will not be sad to see her go.
I think they will be extremely happy, to be honest. They will be delighted. I mean, I wouldn't say parties, but yes, because she is a tough negotiator and she's always been trouble, sort of.
Kurds in Sweden won't be celebrating, though, and many fear that Swedish lawmakers, eager to join NATO, might be willing to agree to further Turkish demands. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
It's Sir Isaac Newton's basic law of physics: what goes up must come down. Space engineers in China surely knew that when they launched a powerful rocket on Sunday.
Three, two, one, down.
Now the rocket is hurtling back toward Earth for an uncontrolled re-entry. Some of it will disintegrate as it plummets through the atmosphere, but not all of it. Experts predict that somewhere between 5 and 9 tons of debris from the rocket will land over the weekend. It sounds pretty scary, but Beijing says the overall risk to people and property is very low, since 75% of the Earth's surface is water, desert, or jungle. Analyst Ted Muehlhaupt agrees. He's with the Aerospace Corporation, a U.S.-based nonprofit.
You know, we're looking at 6 chances in 10 trillion for the risk to a specific individual.
Muehlhaupt said in an online news briefing that there's a 99.5% chance there will be zero injuries.
But 99.99 is the standard, and there's a big difference between 99.5 and 99.99.
If history tells us anything, damage could be done here. In May 2020, debris from the same rocket fell through the sky and landed in the Ivory Coast. Nobody got hurt, but several buildings did get hit. Ted Muehlhaupt said all of this could be avoided.
This is not needed. We have the technology to not have this problem.
If only China had ponied up the extra cash and designed the rocket to avoid an uncontrolled reentry. That's what most other spacefaring nations, including the U.S., typically do. Gang violence in Haiti is wreaking havoc in Port-au-Prince. Yesterday, there was heavy gunfire in and around the Haitian capital. Suspected gang members set fire to a church in a bid to control more territory. According to the UN, in one neighborhood in the capital, Cité Soleil, nearly 500 people have been killed, injured, or disappeared in the space of 1 week. There's also increased anger that guns trafficked from the U.S. are now fueling the violence. Monique Kleska is a former UN development official and now works with a group called the Commission for a Haitian Solution to the Crisis. She joins us from Miami. Monique, first of all, who are these gangs that are responsible for so much violence in Haiti right now?
Well, a lot of them are gangs, young men who, some of them, for example, one of them is a former police officer. One of the leaders is a former teacher. So they are not totally disenfranchised, but they manage to gather other disenfranchised groups. And the allure of guns, of power, of money makes them very powerful. And secondly, the powers that be, the PHTK governments of Michel Martelly and also of Jovenel Moïse, have worked with them so that they can control territories, have supplied some arms, have supplied men, equipment. So they now control close to 50% of the territory, according to human rights organizations. So they are extremely powerful and hold terror kind of advantage over us in that kidnappings, they're sometimes 10 to 20 a day, and the population is terrorized.
Are you saying the gangs have basically been enabled by people in power?
Well, yes, absolutely. Practically every massacre, and there were about 13 massacres documented under the reign of Jovenel Moïse, who himself was assassinated. And right now, we are now in the third massacre under Ariel Henry, the anointed prime minister. The first one was in La Plaine, the second one in Cité Soleil, and they moved the battle now to the Bel Air neighborhood. So it is a battle between the gangs who were supported and aligned with government called the G9 and other gangs who are more independent. And it has been clearly shown in reports that the gangs have received equipment, they have received arms. And one of the reports, it was Harvard Law School and human rights organizations and the UN, the 2018 La Saline massacre, that they clearly said they were crimes against humanity. People are being beheaded, people are being carbonized, houses are being just fire set in them. So this is a takeover of a state by criminal group and a criminal group that has been in power now for the last 10 years and have some gangs working with them as proxies. So this is really terror. We are now living in a terror state in Haiti where the most barbaric things are happening, and I keep on calling it genocide. I know genocide is a heavy word, but we are being killed. And government that has not only the right, but has the obligation to protect us, does nothing, 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 absolutely nothing. We are desperate, and we are saying it's time to rise up. We can no longer continue to live this way because it's not living anymore.
You use the word carbonized, meaning people being burnt or even burnt alive?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And some are beheaded. So this is extremely barbaric. And I am offended by saying it. I am shamed by saying it, that this is happening in my country. But I think we have to put the truth out. And meanwhile, the person who is in power is supported by Joe Biden's government and supported by the UN, supported by France, and in an unholy alliance that they call the core group. So I think it is a choice now between this kind of governance system where it is criminal, it is barbaric, and people are not getting any services, even the most basic ones, and another option, which is where there is a state that respects people's human rights and a state where people can feel free to walk around, people can feel free to actually live in Haiti.
What is the evidence that guns from the U.S. are contributing to the violence?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, Haiti does not make guns. Haiti does not make ammunition. And two, there have been quite a lot of seized guns coming from the U.S., whether it has been in the port of Port-au-Prince in the northwest of Haiti, whether it is in customs. So there has been evidence of that in massive amounts of machine guns and ammunition in these two ports that have come. So you do have the evidence on the ground because the police or the customs authorities, they take pictures of all these guns that are coming in.
Do we know who in the U.S. is sending these weapons?
Well, I think the people that the U.S. arrested were Haitian Americans, some Haitian Americans also who have been arrested in Haiti. And I think one of the things that becomes very evident is it is not organized necessarily traffic. Sometimes they are maybe individuals in the States as well as in Haiti. In the last 2 months, there have been quite a lot of weapons seized at the port and at customs.
Monique, is the gang problem all across Haiti or mostly confined to the capital?
It is mostly confined to the capital. Port-au-Prince is a city under siege, and we are in a population who are living terrorized in our homes. Kidnappers even come inside a home and pull people out. So things must change. And a lot of Haitians lately have been passing on social media examples of Sri Lanka to see, wait a minute, maybe rising up the way Sri Lanka did might be an option. But then the risk is violence, the risk is even more destruction. So we say, let us sit down and talk. Let us sit down and see what can be saved, you know, because we are dying. We are literally dying.
You know, I personally know some people who work with NGOs in Haiti, and one of them recently decided that because of the violence, they were canceling a trip to Port-au-Prince. You're in Miami right now. Is that also for your safety?
No, I needed to breathe. you know, because when you live under arms all the time, shooting, threats of kidnapping, your friends being kidnapped, people being shot, cadavers on the street, etc., you yourself become a victim of the gang terror, whether or not you were shot at or you were kidnapped yourself. And I needed to breathe because I was being terrorized. I mean, it takes me even 2 or 3 days to actually say, oh, wow, I can sleep. There is no shooting. There is none of that going on. So that's why people also are taking the boats. I think just earlier this week, there were 20 or 21 Haitians who died in the waters of Bahamas. And it is heartbreaking. They're trying to get away from that also. So I was able to take a vacation, but others were not perhaps able to take a vacation to get away from the terror and are saying, let's take a boat to get away from this terror that is removing any possible space for you to breathe properly, because they're shooting all over. Even in your home, you're being kidnapped. So that is what is going on. You know, we are living under siege, and the government that is there to protect us does absolutely nothing to protect us, but rather they support the ones who are terrorizing us. So that is what is going on. And we're saying enough, 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 enough.
Monique Leska is a retired United Nations development official and now works with a group called the Commission for a Haitian Solution to the Crisis. She's been speaking with us from Miami. Monique, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
One of the most recognizable guitar riffs in rock history, Eric Clapton's Layla. What's less known is that this song of unrequited love is based on an epic Persian poem written in the 12th century by Nizami Ganjavi. Now the blues rock group the Tedeschi Trucks Band has taken inspiration from this poem, Layla and Majnun, and taken it several steps beyond Clapton's rock classic. This summer, the band has been releasing a new album in four parts, featuring songs that have sprung out of Ganjavi's poem. The project is called I Am the Moon. Part 3, The Fall, drops tomorrow. Gonna get right this time, I hope we did. Backing vocalist and songwriter Mike Madison was crucial in making the Persian poetry connection for the group. Mike, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I understand that Derek Trucks and Susan Tedeschi learned about Nizami Ganjavi from you. How did a 12th century poem and its writer even come up?
Well, I think we're all aware of the poem, Layla and Majnun. You know, I think anybody who's pretty familiar with rock history knows that that was kind of Clapton's well that he went to for his record, Layla. And we had just done a concert at the Laeken Festival with Trey Anastasio from Phish, where we had done the whole Layla record. I had never really dug into the lyrics, and having to learn them all, at a certain point, it almost became kind of comical at cumulatively how whiny it sounded. But I thought, you know, there's got to be more to this. So I went back and read the poem. It's about 80 pages long. And it's true that there's a lot more to it. And Majnun's love madness is kind of what sets the tale in motion. But really, that's a small part of what's really going on. It's really how one person's kind of self-absorption, as it plays out as a form of love, just spins this whole population's world off of its axis. And I thought that was an interesting thing to think about, is how does one person's madness affect the rest of us? And so that's kind of where we took off with that.
So Layla Majnun, 80 pages, as you said, it is an epic piece of work. What makes it significant, both as a piece of literature and in Persian culture?
You know, it's been recognized as kind of the Persian version of Romeo and Juliet, for example. I think every culture kind of has this fateful romance that we all, as a culture, kind of lean towards. The way that it positions love as something that we think we can have control of and that we think we can achieve for ourselves And I think what everybody comes to know and realize is that a lot of it's out of our hands. And so it's that hand of fate in love that I think is so poignant and really speaks to kind of everybody cross-culturally.
So how does this 12th century poet, Persian poet, Nizami Ganjavi, how does he weave the story in the poem? What is it really about?
Well, good question. And again, it starts with Ganjavi. Like, I'm going to have a couple pops of wine and tell you a story. Mm-hmm. But we meet Leila Majnun as very young people in school. And Majnun just kind of develops this fascination with her and she with him. But they're from different classes. And it just seems like it's not fated for them to be together. And so instead of just accepting that, Majnun decides to go cuckoo and ends up out in the desert with this crazy group of wild animals and kind of groupies, love groupies who are like, you're so in love, you know, teach us how to be crazy like you. And from there, that it just goes off the rails. There's battles and close calls and reconciliations, people dying, and it is epic in that scale. But the one thing that drew me in when I read the poem, especially thinking about it in terms of Layla, the Clapton album music, is that so much of the poem is from Layla's perspective, meaning what do I do with this guy? I'm crazy about him too, but he's crazy. Mm. And I'm locked up here in this castle to be protected from him and his armies and stuff. And that's what you don't really get from the Layla that's in the world, the rock Layla. You don't get her perspective. And that was another thing I wanted to try to address with some of the songwriting. The world keeps on spinning.
So the Tedeschi Trucks Band's latest project, I Am the Moon, comes out this summer in four parts. Episode 1, Crescent, it's titled, came out in May, Ascension in June. Episode 3, this week. How do you see this inspiration of Leila Majnun fitting into the whole cycle?
We weren't trying to make a musical out of it or anything, or a piece of musical theater. We just kind of identified some of these themes. Some specific episodes, because they were kind of rich with imagery and language and things with that. But also we wanted to leave it open to our own personal interpretation and really hear, you know, about five or six of us in the group, whether it's Derek and Susan or Gabe Dixon or Tyler Greenwell, the drummer. We did a lot of writing for it, and we wanted to leave it open for our own personal interpretations.
Mike, you've been part of the Trucks Tedeschi universe as a vocalist and songwriter for something like 20 years, I think. How does the band and projects like I Am the Moon nourish you as an artist?
Well, we were lucky and unlucky in that we were going to take some time off in 2020, and then we had this mandated time off. And so this was really the first time we were able to be a little more considered about how we were going to approach our creativity. We tour so much that you just don't have a lot of time to talk. It was really nice just to have some time and be like, well, what are we going to do? And how are we going to communicate? And so I had this idea of, well, we all just played the Layla record. Why don't we just read this poem and see if something comes out of it?
Mike Madison, singer and songwriter with the Tedeschi Trucks Band. The new project, inspired in part by 12th century Persian poetry, is called I Am the Moon. Mike, terrific to speak with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that is our show on this Thursday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Be safe, stay strong. We're back with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.